time, John and Dick begin the TechNet. Main purpose of the technical net is education. We try to teach each other how all this hardware works. How does a radio wave really propagate in space? What does it look like if you could see it? How do those antennas work? What is this thing called antenna effective capture area? How do you maximize it? And so on. Lots of brain power exists in the tri-state area of northern New Jersey, eastern Connecticut, southern New York, Long Island. And we also get check-ins from some of the brain power in Toronto and Ottawa, our Canadian friends, and quite a few others. And we look forward to all that. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and along with John, KC2WGV, we try to organize this thing. A person signs into the technical net. Let me drop. By giving John and Dick your call letters, your name. You have to give me the name because I'm so forgetful. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Two other things I want to bring to your attention. Number one, the February issue of CQ Ham Radio Magazine has an extremely nice article about the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club and what their involvement was during Hurricane Sandy. And that was the second of two parts. I don't have the January issue, so the January issue is probably the first part. The second part is in the February issue. So if you haven't gotten a hold of a copy of Ham Radio, Amateur Radio, CQ Amateur Radio is the name of the thing, which you can usually get at some of the better bookstores. And quite a series of articles in there about Gloria and what happened. Very nicely done. Another thing worth considering, let me drop, is that the jamming that this repeater has experienced has been going on for almost 3 years now, this particular jammer. The quickest way to find out if something is valuable to you is to have somebody threaten to take it away. And so there's a very unhappy individual in the New York City area who for going on 3 years now has been doing jamming. And so consider joining the fox hunting groups. If you get a hold of Andy, WA2CDL, Eric, KD2EJ, or Bernie, K2YO, guarantee they could use your help, because if we keep doing what we've always done, we'll keep getting what we've always got, if you know what I mean. We can get angry at the individual, but that's not the solution. He's got a pretty sad situation of some kind going on, where he seems to get pleasure out of making life miserable for other people. And we can do one of two things, light a candle or curse the darkness, if you know what I mean. So consider joining those efforts, because I suspect more resources of some kind are going to be required. Otherwise, this can go on for another 3 years, and that's not desirable. Lucky for all the workarounds that we've got on the TechNet, we managed to work in the presence of all of that jamming. But it slows us down, and certain of the weaker signals until people get a stronger antenna have trouble getting their question through. Okay, at this time I'm going to give you an example of what a good sign-in would sound like. W2PJF, Vito and Yes. And that would be a good check-in. Give me your call letters and name right now if you've got a question or a comment for the TechNet. K2LIW, we're listening.
Thank you, XGN. And a question for the after the poll. If you can find time for it, I hope you've read the email. Kind of interesting.
Yes, I did see that email with reference to those various kinds of cores of transformers, and I've got some comments on that one. Okay, so we got Wes checking in. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RAW.
82AMZ, and yes, I got a question.
W01, Joe, yes, I have a question.
2-9 Bravo, I have a question.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
2MU, yes.
Yes. Put this space, you plug it in, check.
Okay, we got a good crew here. Wes, Joe, AMZ, Barry, and Neil. I think I missed somebody. Let me get the numbers here right. One, two, drop out there. I heard the something 2 and yes. What was that again?
All right, K2MU, yes. Any better?
Okay, Mumpy's uncle, we got you, Bernie. All righty. There was some drop out there. Maybe maybe the modulation was a little bit heavy and you were dropping out of the machine. Okay, Wes, you did have a email with reference to that transformer YouTube video in which a person was using various kinds of cores that did and didn't stick together and gave him signals that flow between the primary and secondary. Is that the particular email that you want to discuss with N2XJN, K2LAW?
Yeah, that is correct. That's a long email, but I sent you the two links at the top of it, and I stated that everything below is not really important. I mean, it's important, but not for the discussion of the technet. It's rather the nice curiosity. And I wonder if you had a chance to see those two videos. I also asked Glenn, and he most likely would be talking to you. So whether you want to take it right now, if Glenn is there, or just you want to go with it after call. Enter it here.
Now, we're going to discuss a particular YouTube video for you and I and anyone else in the New York City area. To talk about a particular video and what we saw would be a little bit unfair if other people don't have access to it. So was that particular URL, that website, in other words, given to Bernie, the K2YO website, so that other people can easily find it? So was it given to Bernie's website? Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
I believe it was, because usually what happens is all of the emails I just sent by me to Bernie or by John to Bernie. Anyhow, the email was sent to Eric, you, John, who else? I believe it was also to Bernie. And Tracy.
So when we discuss a particular YouTube video or some other website, and Glenn and I will be discussing one tonight in which we're going to be showing a picture of what the actual RF wave in free space, what it really looks like, how's the best way that people have created a model as to what it looks like. What Bernie has done is to volunteer his services at something called Bernie@HuntFamily.org, I think it is, or is it HuntFamily.com, I keep forgetting. But Bernie@HuntFamily, you go to that particular website and you can see the exact URL that we're discussing at that time, so we're not keeping it a secret. Let me drop. John, correct me on that. Is it Bernie@HuntFamily.org, or is it Bernie@HuntFamily.com? KC2WGB, K2LAW. And maybe John's not there yet tonight. Okay, well, eventually I get that straightened out. So.
Bernie Hunt, Bernie@HuntFamily.com.
Okay, that's it, Bernie@HuntFamily.com. So you go there and you'll see the websites that we're going to be talking about tonight. Now, this particular YouTube video, the man is putting voltages into the primary of a transformer. The transformer is built into two separate sections, an upper U and a lower U, so to speak, and he puts them together, and he uses various kinds of iron. And the big difference that happens with various kinds of iron is that some iron has a lot of what's called retentivity. In other words, you give it a steady-state current in one direction on a solenoid coil wrapped on that iron, and you create a strong magnetic field in one direction, and depending on the kind of iron, fine laminations, for instance, usually have no retentivity, but certain kinds of solid chunks of iron have very high retentivity. That's a fancy way of saying that the magnet holds its characteristics as a steady-state magnet, and therefore, once you put current into the primary, you find that the two halves, the upper U-shaped object and the lower U-shaped object, stick together very heavily with a magnetic field, or they do not. And what the guy was doing in one case is, by way of a secondary winding, on that transformer, depending on whether the secondary winding was short-circuited or not short-circuited, determines whether or not the spike of current you put into the primary does allow magnetic field to occur, and therefore magnetization takes place. This is my partial explanation of what I think is going on. Let me drop. Well, in one particular case, he had a kind of iron that has strong retentivity. And if the secondary winding was open-circuited, and he puts DC current or a pulse of DC current into the primary winding, the transformer core becomes magnetized, and it becomes difficult to separate the upper U magnetic circuit from the lower U magnetic circuit. In another experiment, the exact same piece of iron, by putting a short circuit on the secondary winding, you're really creating what some people would call a bucking magnetic field, an opposing magnetic field, or a magnetic field, or an operation of the secondary winding where, by way of Faraday's law, the transformer's driving force on the primary winding is trying to establish a changing magnetic field. The short circuit on the secondary winding would not allow the change to take place, and therefore no magnetization takes place. So that particular YouTube video, once some understanding takes place as to what is going on there, it does give you quite a bit of feeling, quite a bit of hands-on experience as to what happens with certain kinds of cores that will retain their magnetic field and other kinds of cores that will not. So we're slowly discovering that an awful lot of the magic of transformers and radio waves and a lot of the electronics we use and MRI machines, an awful lot of the magic is really magnetics and magnetic fields. Let me drop. And that YouTube video can give you a good feeling for some of these effects. It gives you a kind of a hands-on experience to how magnetic fields work in various situations. So that's some of what I think I saw in that YouTube video. I wonder if that's what you saw also with N2XJN, K2LAW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, there is a significant phenomenon that when two types of core is compared, and there are two parts, two videos, part one and part two, and he used two different kind of cores, and in the second one, the core is more like a typical windage, not made out of the E and I plates. The effect in the video at, I believe, 549 is very much unconventional. Normally, any current flowing in superconducting shorted coil decays in milliseconds, and yet here the coil exerts its influence for 3 seconds after lift. It's not very much convenient that the experimenter did not wait it longer than that. I have never seen this effect in such a drastic comparison. I'm really trying to do this by myself and see how it goes. Ladies and gentlemen, if the shorted coil maintains its effect indefinitely, then it must do so because the is an electric current flowing in its winding. If no current were flowing in it, then opening the coil would have no effect. The electric current tries to create its own magnetic flux to oppose any change in magnetic flux that was already present in the center of the coil. So this flux was generated by the line of atomic spins of ferromagnetic reminiscence of the core. The change in magnetic flux is an attempt by gravity trying to separate two halves of the core and increase the gap between them, and consequently reluctance the whole magnetic circuit, and the coil opposes the change according to the Lenz law. But thank you.
conventionally a non-superconducting fluid coil is coupled during the coil separation by several milliseconds, but not much longer than that. Usually the lower the resistance, the longer is the delay. And this is because the windings of the coil are non-superconducting, and they might have a resistance. And any current flowing in the resistance is always converted to the heat. So the heat represents the real dissipation, not enough to feel by hand, but still is there. So normally the power dissipation drains the energy induced or stored in the coil very quickly, but here's what happened there. The guy shorted the coil, and with keeping the shorted coil, he couldn't separate it. But when he they opened the coil, the one half simply dropped. And that was in the coil that was not really keeping any magnetization at all. It was only that kept magnetization when you add one coil to the core and the coil was a closed loop. It looks like, I'm not saying it is, it looks like there is a current that is flowing without any source, but it's constantly flowing and it's keeping the magnetization in the core that was immune to any magnetization whatsoever. And that was in video number two. And that's what triggered my curiosity. So the shorted coil delayed separation for only 5 seconds, and still a long time, so RL length by 5 seconds is much more convenient than forever, whatever. The author doesn't seem to realize that the current is shorted, in the shorted coil is a reaction to the change of mode of it starting flowing when he picks up the cord, not before that. I probably didn't explain it very much clear, but maybe you got something from it, Eric.
Yeah, well, when it comes to a magnetic core accepting magnetization or not accepting magnetization, when there's a coil of wire around that core, like a secondary winding, we're really talking about a kind of a time constant here. Two of the more famous kinds of time constant are called RC time constant or L over R. In other words, in the case of RC, if I'm taking a capacitor that's discharged, and I'm putting a resistor across it, and watching how long it takes to discharge it, that's called an RC time constant. You take the resistance in ohms and the capacitance in farad, multiply the two together, and that tells you the time constant in seconds. And the same thing when it comes to an inductor. L over R is the time constant. If the inductance is rated in Henry's and your resistance is rated in ohms, in this, the resistance of the inductor, of the coil, and you divide that resistance into the inductance, again you come up with seconds. So if a person can wind a coil skillfully enough, if there's a whole lot of inductance to it, he could come up with a pretty long time constant. The time constant can go to infinity if you're able to make the resistance go to zero. Inductance and Henry divided by zero in resistance would be a time constant forever. That's exactly what you're doing in an MRI machine, or what you're doing with the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. By using cryogenics and exotic materials to make the coil, you now create superconductance, and therefore, when you've got a coil with superconducting wire, it will not allow a change in magnetic field. If you, by some means, establish a magnetic field and then establish superconductivity of the coil will maintain the magnetic field forever. And so, could you get a time constant app that goes out to 5?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Could you get a time constant that goes out to 5 seconds in that video? With skill, with the right kind of materials, it's definitely possible. There have been experiments where a current was set up in a superconducting ring, and you come back a year later, and the exact same amount of current is there. So this property called superconductivity at times can be very handy. And so some of that is what's going on here, some really long time constants. So it's a mixture of retentivity of the coil, the amount of resistance of the winding, and whether or not the winding will allow a magnetic field to either increase or decrease when the winding is short-circuited. So that's part of what that video is showing. And not all of it is as super clear as we'd like it to be. It wasn't really done as an instruction. The guy was just showing you, I'm doing this and watch what happens. And some of those things are a little bit hard to explain if you don't understand the difference between a core that has no retentivity, a magnetic core that has high retentivity, a high-quality coil acting as a secondary with or without short-circuited windings, and whether or not there's AC/DC current going into the primary winding that's establishing the magnetic field in the first place. So kind of an interesting video. Anything else you want to add to this one before we go on to the next person, Wes, into X-JN, K2RIW?
Yeah, into X-JN. Yeah, I wonder what Glenn thinks about it, because I spoke to him shortly before the TechNet, didn't have a chance to hear what he said, because somebody was messing up with very close to my door. Anyhow, well, the puzzle here is that for me it looks like a Brockhausen noise or effect that is here, but I don't really very much agree with what you're saying. We deal with the simple metal core made specially for the transformer. So we have a place, we have the insulation, we have a very low the eddy current in it. It's fine, but this thing is immune to magnetization of any kind till you give the coil, and it's shorted coil. And then you come after a certain time of a year, you cannot separate it until you just take the winding out. The question is, what is that you're changing? What is that you're changing by disconnecting the coil that has no power? Was it because there was something that was flowing in the short circuit over there? I mean, that's what I'm. What I simply don't understand. Maybe Glenn would be able to say it's cured.
Let's see if Glenn's on frequency. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. You there, Glenn? Yeah, maybe Glenn's going to join us a little bit later. It is possible to establish a magnetic field in a magnetic circuit where ordinarily the magnetic circuit would have very low retentivity, in other words, very little ability to become a permanent steady-state magnet. It would ordinarily discharge itself and become a non-magnet, similar to the kinds of magnets they use in a stockyard, in a junkyard to pick up automobiles and other pieces of steel. That's a magnet. Once you turn off the current, the magnetic field goes away. You could be using that kind of material. And after you establish the magnetic field, the winding that's also on that magnetic circuit, if the winding itself has a high enough quality to it, by that I mean a lot of inductance and very little resistance, where the time constant, which is L over R, inductance divided by resistance, could be a very big number. Many minutes and maybe even an hour is possible if you make the coil high enough in quality as far as lots of inductance, usually meaning lots of turns, and very little resistance because you've used really high-quality materials. You can get extremely long time constants. And with a long time constant, the magnetic field that you established with whatever kind of a circuit, and then you short-circuit that high-quality L over R circuit, it will not allow the magnetic field to decay. It will retain it for long periods of time. That's a peculiar effect. A shorted turn of high-quality coil will not allow a change in magnetic field. It won't allow it to increase, won't allow it to decrease. Somewhat similar to what could happen with the spark coil of your automobile. Let me drop it. In the case of the spark coil of an automobile, where ordinarily the 12 volts through a very small resistor is put through a primary winding, a lot of current flows, a magnetic field is established, and at the instant the old-fashioned Kettering-type ignition system, the points open up, you're trying to create an instantaneous disconnection of the current that's creating the magnetic field, and as such, you get an inductive kickback, is the word that the words they use for it. The high voltage secondary winding can give you easily 10 or 20,000 volts that goes across the spark coil, goes across the spark plug, and fires that particular cylinder. If that coil, in the sparking coil of an automobile, if it develops one single shorted turn anywhere in all of those windings, that inductive kickback no longer takes place. The primary magnetization of the current flowing through the points, through the one-ohm resistor and putting 12 amperes into that primary winding and the magnetic field it establishes, most of that still takes place. But the presence of one shorted turn means that the normal inductive kickback giving you 10 or 20,000 volts is now extremely slowed down by that shorted turn. It's not allowing the magnetic field to decay. That's where the spark is coming from, the decay, the rapid decay of the magnetic field. And if it doesn't take place, all of a sudden, instead of 10 or 20,000 volts, you get 10 or 20 volts out of it, so to speak. Your spark plug doesn't work, and your automobile is not running. So there are lots of people who run into that mode of failure of a spark coil. So a shorted turn with a high enough quality to it has some peculiar characteristics of not allowing the magnetic field to increase or decrease when you want it. Okay, when we have our deeper discussion later on with Glenn, maybe we'll get into this a little bit further, Wes. I'm going to go on to the next person now, which was Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y, go right ahead. K-2-L-I-W on the tech net.
Good evening, Dick, the TechNet, W-H-O-L-Y. This question is related to the question I asked last week about having snow on a yagging antenna and causing a tremendous amount of signal loss on that antenna. My question is basically in two parts. Number one, if you were to invert the antenna on its horizontal axis by 180 degrees, would that minimize it because snow or ice would have less of a chance of collecting on the driven element? Instead of having it point up, you have it point down. Number two, if you did that, would there be any noticeable performance difference of the antenna? Back to you.
Now, run that by one more time. You're putting snow and ice on the antenna and changing something up and down or left and right. I got distracted for a second. It's my fault, Joe, so run that by one more time. You got it, Joe.
Okay, this question goes back to the question I think was on here like last week. And Bill QGZ come on, and he mentioned something that made a lot of sense. This probably happened in one location, more than both, but, you know, whatever. Where I got possibly a very high collection of ice in an ice storm we had with the snowstorm about a week or two ago. And I noticed I had high signal loss, very, 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 very rapid attenuation in the signal path between my house and a repeater site. And then after a length of time, it went away, and it sort of went back to normal. My question was two parts, to try to, you know, minimize that happening again, even though it only happens, you know, probably the winter. If the ice indeed was causing that type of effect to happen, and the driven element is pointing up, typically with a vertically polarized antenna, if you take the Yagi and rotate it 180 degrees on its horizontal axis and have the driven element, the hot side, so to speak, pointing down instead of pointing up, the first part of the question, do you think that would minimize the thing collecting ice, snow, whatever, on the driven element and having less of a chance of shorting it out? That's one question. That's one part of it. The second part is, if you do this, would there be any noticeable change in the performance of the antenna? Back to you.
Yeah, there's quite a few things going on here all at once, Joe. I know that when I was using the Ed Tilton Yagi W1HDQ, a respected 13-element Yagi design for the 32 megacycle so-called sideband portion of the band way back in the late 60s. That was a popular antenna, the Tilton Yagi. What was unique about it is that the design was a so-called critical design. In other words, as you move the individual parasitic elements closer and closer to resonance, as opposed to having them short enough to act as directors, and you start moving them closer to resonance, you do get a little bit more gain, but you're at the at the edge of a cliff, so to speak, with just a little bit of a change of resonant frequency of the elements. They flip over from director to reflector. So droplets of water dew on the antenna early in the morning would make it fire in the wrong direction. In other words, if the guy was west of me, I would have to aim the Yagi antenna to the east in order to be able to hear him off the back of the antenna. When the water forms in the form of ice, ice is a peculiar material. You carefully measure at any of the normal frequencies we use what is the dielectric constant of water. How much does it add capacitance to a capacitor? Water's got a dielectric constant of around 80. In other words, you've got two plates of a capacitor, you've got some very high quality water, water with no salt in it, no mineral matter, so it's not conductive. You put the water between the two plates, and however many microfarads the plate has, it goes up by 80 times because of the presence of the water compared to air. So water's got a very high dielectric constant. Take that exact same amount of water, that exact same glass of water, so to speak, and you freeze it. The dielectric constant of the water jumps down from 80 down to approximately 3. That's a huge change.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And another funny thing happens. Water itself is an extremely radio-lossy material, obvious by the fact that the water that's in your food is doing 90-some-odd% of all of the cooking in your microwave oven. Each one of those molecules of the water, which is a polarized molecule, that molecule flips back and forth at 2.4 gigahertz rate, and it's trying to follow the RF wave, and it does it with a little bit of a delay, and it's a lossy mechanism. So the water flips back and forth, absorbs the RF energy, does a beautiful job. You put an ice cube alongside of a glass of water in your microwave oven, and you run it full blast for a single minute. The ice cube does nothing, and the water comes close to boiling. Ice itself, not only does it have a very low dielectric constant, 3 instead of 80, but its loss tangents, its ability to absorb RF energy, changes, I don't know the exact number, but it's probably at least 100 to 1. So ice as a lossy material is maybe 100 times less lossy than water, and as a dielectric material, it's 3 versus 80, so it's got a huge change. The bottom line of that is that you take a frozen hamburger out of the freezer, and you put it in your microwave oven, and if you're not programming the microwave oven to run in the so-called defrost cycle, where you just simply pour on full microwave energy for a minute or two to cook your hamburger or to heat it up, you'll find out that one little spot on the hamburger will eventually melt, the ice will melt, and that part will cook real fast, and the icy part will sit there and do nothing. And the bottom line is that hamburger comes out of the microwave oven as a really soggy mess, where portions of it are cooked or overcooked, other portions of it are still frozen or raw, because of this huge differential characteristic of ice versus water. Now, let's go back to your antenna. Let me drop. So, lots of guys have worried themselves sick because their microwave dish, way back in the days of television receive-only terminal, the so-called 10-foot diameter dish for doing satellite reception, snow would form on the dish and people would lose a lot of sleep saying, I've got to come up with some kind of a mechanism of melting off the snow, otherwise I'm going to get no reception. Well, other than the fact that the snow had weight and it would tilt the dish a little bit and maybe change the aiming, other than that, the snow itself is an extremely low-loss material. You're wasting your time to worry about it unless you've got a huge amount of it in the microwave dish. The snow is almost purely transparent, almost like air. Ice comes close to that. So ice on an antenna is nowhere near as detrimental as you would think, even though your eye sees a very solid material. Now, when it's a really slushy, watery ice, yeah, that's something different. So, in the case of a vertically polarized antenna, let's assume I've got a vertically polarized dipole, and for whatever reason, ice is forming on the low end of the dipole or the upper end of the dipole, and you flip the dipole upside down, and you want to know if it's going to make improvement in the performance, which is part of what I think is one of your questions. Let me drop. In order for the dipole to do its thing, like every other antenna, it must first resonate. So whether or not you are doing something to kill the resonance, by putting a object on the upper half of the dipole or the lower half of the dipole really doesn't matter. You're killing the resonance, you're killing the performance of the antenna. And whether you do it on the top and flip it over, or do it on the bottom and flip it over, in either case, putting ice on one end of a dipole versus the other end is going to have an extremely small change in the pattern of the antenna. It's still a dipole-like structure, and it's going to have an antenna pattern like a dipole. And putting a dipole upside down doesn't change the pattern, so I think you're going to get very little improvement out of that. And should you go through heroics in order to get rid of the ice, my experience tells me that the best way to tolerate ice and snow and other perturbing things on a tuned antenna, whether it be a Kolliner, Yagi, or whatever, is to make the elements wide. When you go from 8-inch diameter elements of the Ed Tilton Yagi, the W1HDQ, that we discussed a little bit last week, but I could finally find out his name that I've forgotten, and you go to 3/16 diameter elements or bigger, a huge improvement takes place when it comes to lack of vulnerability of detuning phenomena. As you make the elements wider and wider, you get all kinds of benefits, and it's opposite of common sense. One of the patents in my name is for a Yagi antenna, and I guess that patent was issued somewhere around 2005. The original Yagi was invented by Mr. Hindusugi Yagi in 1928, and he got a patent on it in that time. And in 2005, I and one other guy I'm working with reinvented the Yagi and got a pattern reissued. And you're about to ask, what in the world did these guys...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
What in the world did these guys do 75 years later? And the answer was, instead of making the element a 500th of a wavelength in diameter, we made it 50 times wider than that. We made the element something in the vicinity of an eighth of a wavelength in width by making them out of sheet metal. When you redesign a Yagi with extremely wide elements, you get a huge amount of benefit in performance. The apparent resistivity of the elements goes down. They need a little bit of shortening in order to reestablish the resonance in order to do the tuning, but the antenna itself becomes very broadband, very high in performance. The net result was that particular antenna had a tuned standing wave ratio of 1.05, inclusive across 902 to 928 megacycles. That's a 3% bandwidth, and the average person talks about the bandwidth of an antenna as that frequency range over which you get a 2-to-1 VIVLA. Our definition for that particular application for a radio frequency identification reader is that we wanted to have extremely low standing wave ratio, under 1.1. That antenna has under 1.1 of standing wave ratio across a 3% bandwidth, 902 to 928, on a 3-element Yagi with 6 dB over isotropic gain. That was the nature of the patent. There's a couple of little doodads that were added to it. But making the elements super wide, common sense would lead you to believe, common sense would lead you to believe that when the elements become very large in diameter or very wide, they're going to create a huge shadow for the signal coming in. You would think that. The radio doesn't look at it that way. It looks at that chunk of metal, the radio wave coming in, and decides, is that resonant or non-resonant? That's all it cares about. The exact shape doesn't matter. The so-called Simone antenna that Kent Britton, WA5VJB, made by taking CD disks, the disks that are used for memory devices on computers, he stacked 4 or 5 of them on a phenolic rod and made them the right diameter so that they became tuned elements. That was an Enfire Yagi where the elements were circles of flat material. The CD-ROMs were the individual elements. That looks like it should be a pure shadowing antenna, where the upper director should kill the signal going through that string of elements to try to get to the driven element. And they put it on the antenna range during an antenna contest, and it performed like a charm. So what your eye sees and what the radio wave sees are extremely different on dipole and Yagi-like elements. And so there's a huge advantage of making them wide. When you do, they become very difficult for the environment to detune them. So try to keep the ice and snow off if you want to. But what Bill was telling you, QGZ, was that commercial commercial antenna he was using, where the elements were very large in diameter, all of a sudden that thing was a gangbuster antenna where nothing could kill it unless you went out there and sawed off some of those elements, if you know what I mean. I know this is not exactly the answer you're looking for, but maybe it helps a little bit, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, the antenna elements are not 1/8-inch antenna. It does not resemble a Quickcraft antenna, because that sounds like what you're almost describing. It doesn't resemble that at all. It's a commercial head antenna, and the antenna elements, except for the driven element assembly, are all 3/8 diameter aluminum rod that's welded to the boom. The element diameter for the driven element is basically the same thing, but it's simply not welded. It's fixed with a cap screw type of assembly onto the side of the boom, and the injector, you know, feeds that. I just was thinking if that was getting shorted out, partially shorted out, if the antenna flipped 180 on a horizontal axis, the snow and ice would have less of a chance or less ability to cling to the antenna and short something out. But maybe I'm just thinking wrong.
Okay, then. Once you've got elements that are 3/8 of an inch diameter, which by my standards are very large diameter, very invulnerable parasitic elements, and now you're getting some funny effect, you believe, on the driven element. Depending on how the driven element is fed, whether it be gamma match, T match, or a simple dipole feed with a ballon in the center and whatever, if water or ice is existing across the gap of the center of the antenna, across the gap of the capacitor, that's the gamma rod, that can detune the daylights out of it. I'll give you that one. When the antenna became lower in performance, it sure would be nice, Joe, if you had been able to measure the standing wave ratio at that time. The quickest way you, in the real world, kill the performance of an antenna is to have its standing wave ratio go sky high. You know, a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio is going to give you lots of dBs of loss. In theory, you only get 3 dB of loss at a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. You get a half a dB of loss at a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So measuring the standing wave ratio is the quickest way to find out what's going on. If the antenna with 3/8-inch diameter elements had a reasonable standing wave ratio, then if you put that antenna on an antenna range, I'm convinced there's a 98% chance you'd get full performance out of that antenna, as long as it's got real visuar of that driven element, if you know what I mean. In that case, where you experience a lot of desensitization of a repeater or a particular path, I am guessing that the precipitation noise going into the receiver was raising the noise floor. When you get the right kind of, let me drop it.
It was doing it at both ends, Dick.
And you could be having the precipitation noise on both ends. So when you got a certain weather condition, and for the weather condition to exist over a 10-mile path, it's easy to happen. So raising the noise floor on both ends could have been taking place. In the case of an FM receiver where you're getting AM-like noise, it's very difficult to hear it in the loudspeaker, so to speak, unless you got just the right kind of a threshold signal coming in at the time. If you had the ability to flip that receiver into AM reception, I know it's not easy. Listening to the AGC voltage on the FM limiter, so to speak, would give you a clue. I am guessing there's a high probability on both ends you experienced a noise floor raise because of the weather condition, and once the snow stopped happening, once the rain stopped happening, was that around the time where the sensitivity came back? Or did you have to wait until all of the snow and ice melted before the sensitivity came back? Give us a quick description, Joe, as to how long and under what conditions did the sensitivity of that particular RF link come back into life? The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It seemed like as the snow decreased or diminished in its activity, eventually the link came back to life and became usable in both directions. But here's another part of the puzzle here, okay? You're thinking that the both antennas at each end had high precipitation static, okay? I was at the radio with a portable inside my car, key to repeater, and listened to my what I would call my downlink from the same site. I couldn't hear it on my mobile radio. I could hear the repeater, but I could not hear the downlink on my mobile radio. That's another part of the puzzle. It certainly seemed like the problem was at the repeater site where it was not radiating a very good signal. Back to you.
And about the only way I can envision where it doesn't radiate a pretty good signal is very high standing wave ratio. From what you're describing, for Mother Nature to do something to the antenna, to drastically change the antenna pattern, it's possible. In the case of a station master, let me think about that for a minute. I guess if you take enough ice and snow on the outside of the radome of a station master, where you shift its resonant frequency, and as such, what happens with a station master is that a vertical collinear array is trying to make an antenna pattern that looks like a pancake. And if you, if I simply added a top hat capacitor on the outside of the radome, at the top, at the absolute tip of that antenna, for instance, where I lower its resonant frequency, what would happen in that case is the antenna would, let's see now, an antenna always fires in the direction of delay. I'm creating an extra delay. That antenna, the pancake pattern, would pick up above the horizon. It would become a very wide cone as opposed to a pancake. It would be a pancake with a push down in the center, and the rim is high, and you'd be transmitting a signal above the horizon. So that's another possibility. So change in pattern from the collinear, and that would certainly affect in both directions, because the pattern is squirting the energy in the wrong direction, if you know what I mean. Whether you're transmitting or receiving, you're going to suffer, or very high standing wave ratio. I know for you to have found out during that incident what was the standing wave ratio. I'll admit that wouldn't be easy. But the change in pattern of a collinear, I can envision that. And by the way, if the exact same amount of ice is in the exact same position of the collinear, and you're tilting that pancake above the horizon, and now by some magic you go out there and you take that collinear antenna and you flip it upside down so that now the cone is below the horizon as opposed to up above the horizon, I think you're going to suffer almost the exact same amount.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
With that collinear flipped upside down, I think you're going to suffer almost the exact same amount of loss. So these are some of my guesses. You got a tough case there, Joe. W2RYY, Q2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I guess you didn't catch my comment. The performance of the repeater was not changed. I could still key it up in a portable out by me, and I could hear it fine in a mobile or on a portable. The link system was the problem, not the repeater antenna. It really had nothing to do with it. All that said, what happened when I keyed up with a portable, I keyed up on the repeater frequency with the portable in the car and tuned my mobile to the link frequency, my downlink frequency, and I could not hear that downlink frequency. It wasn't readable on my mobile radio. That's the point I was trying to make. So it certainly seemed like something at the repeater site with my Yagi used on the link frequency, where that seemed like that's where the problem was coming from. Because not only couldn't my house hear the link from the repeater site, my mobile couldn't hear it either.
Okay, so the link was a Yagi at the repeater site, aimed at your QTH, I presume. And so now, did that Yagi link antenna jump high in VISWA? Is about the only thing I can think of. Because to change the pattern of a Yagi by way of snow and ice, very difficult. I mean, the way a Yagi is physically designed, it's got a whole lot of what's called moment arm. To change its pattern, you've got to do heroic things. like really rotating the Yagi on a azimuth elevation positioner, if you know what I mean. You've got to physically move it to change its pattern. So I'm now slowly concluding radio noise would not fit it, because the link, I presume, works in two directions, and you seem to be telling me that your handy-talkie couldn't talk to the repeater through its link, or you couldn't hear the link into your handy-talkie. So it sounds like the antenna at the repeater site, the link antenna, went way down in performance. I'm slowly concluding either a lot of water in the wrong place or a lot of VISWA on that driven element is my best guess from what I'm hearing now, Joe. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to hear the repeater on the link on the portable. It can hear it here, but it's not really the best thing to use it. I'm using it here mobile in a car with a quarter wave antenna, and it has enough bandwidth to be able to operate under the altitude and frequency pairs that I'm talking about without any really degradation at all for performance. What I said was, I keep the key to the repeater with my portable inside the car from 7-8 miles away, and I'm pretty close to my home QTH, not too far away, but in the line of the antenna's pattern from the repeater site. And I could hit the repeater with the portable, but I couldn't hear the downlink on my mobile radio. So it made me think there was something wrong with the Yagi or something related to it at the repeater site. Could I mention the visual at the time it happened? If I ran over there real fast, I probably could have done it, but that wasn't the best thing to I'm thinking of doing that particular night. So this still remains a little bit of a mystery. So that I only brought up the question because I thought maybe if they was collecting water ice on the dipole element, and it doesn't have a gamma match, it's just simply like an open dipole or an uninsulated element going up and a grounded element going down. I thought by flipping the things back, you know, 180 on a horizontal axis, I'd have less chance of collecting ice or whatever and shorting out that element to ground. Back to you.
It does sound like it's worth a try. And so, can you think of any other way of weatherproofing that driven element, Joe? Is there any way you could cake foam, Teflon, or whatever around the critical portions of that driven element such that the snow and ice can't get close to the real working parts of it? Is there a way you could modify that antenna, Joe? What do you think?
Well, I know they make commercial Yagis of a similar style with a ray dome built around it, completely around the dipole element. It's made to do that. Whether I could take something and make something external to put around the entire driven element assembly, it's a possibility. I'd have to think about that, to think about how clever I'd have to make something to make it do that. That may be what I have to do then, ultimately, make it resemble something else it's not. That's a possibility. Okay, back to you. Go on to the next guy. This is going to pretty much be done beating this same thing to death because it's only going to probably happen in the wintertime anyway. It's never happened during high rainstorms. I don't think I have water in the cable or anything like that because after a length of time, performance came back. So I don't think it's an issue with the weatherproofing or water in the cable or anything like that. So back to you, Nick.
I agree with you, Joe. Doesn't sound like water in the cable. It certainly wouldn't disappear that fast. It does sound like something funny going on in that driven element. And there are ways you can take the critical gap of the driven element, that's where the RF energy is really applied to it, and weatherproofing it. Or you can take the brute force approach and literally build a ray dome around the driven element. PVC pipe, thin wall PVC pipe. It's going to give you a little bit of detuning. But that detuning is only electronic detuning. PVC with reasonable thickness at your frequencies is very low in loss. Yes, the capacitance effect of it is going to lower the frequency of the driven element. If you're willing to shorten the driven element by the right proportion, bring it back to resonant inside of the PVC pipe, you're in business. And if you can find thin wall PVC pipe, like so-called irrigation pipe, of the right diameter, and even if the diameter is too big, you're literally building a ray dome. And with PVC-like material and its glue and or epoxies and so on, and hot glue, there's all kinds of ways you can make a ray dome around that driven element, Joe. The rest of the parasitic elements at 3/8 diameter, I think they're a real moose. You're not going to affect those with snow and ice. They're just going to sit there and keep right on cranking, in my opinion. Next person on the list is Mike, KD2AMZ. Go right ahead, Mike, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you very much. This is KD2AMZ. And I got a real simple question that shouldn't take any more than two minutes to hopefully answer. During the summer, one of my projects is I'm going to be installing a different antenna. That's not the issue. The question is direct burial, coax. Any recommendations? Anything special about direct burial as in regular, you know, electric wiring, you know, with empty, plain old buried? Any suggestions, ideas, again, for direct burial of coax? KD2AMZ.
another hard line, 70 ohm hard line that's used by cable television companies. It's made for direct burial for 20 years. It's hard line with an outer polyvinyl jacket, and unless you really dig through it with some kind of machinery, I think rodents don't like it. They leave it alone, and it's made for direct burial. And your first question is going to be, gee, that's 70 ohm cable, and I've got a 50 ohm system. And there's a simple way you can get around that problem, Mike, and that is on the piece of hardline cable, you take a piece of paper tape, you stick it to the cable, and you write 50 ohms on the cable, and you make sure that that portion of the cable faces toward the transmitter or faces toward the receiver. You convince your transmitter and receiver that it's a 50 ohm cable, even though it's really 70 ohms, and you go ahead and use it. As you can tell, I'm joking a little bit. If somebody handed you a piece of hardline cable, cable TV type cable, and they led you to believe it's 50 ohms and you believe them and it's really 70, in the worst case, that would create a 1.2 standing wave ratio, 70 versus 50, if you divide one into the other. And for the average guy, with laboratory equipment, you'd have great trouble measuring the detriment that's going to cause you. On top of that, let me drop. The 70 ohm cable, hardline cable, is for the same diameter a hell of a lot lower in loss than anything else you're likely to own. So that you come out way ahead. So that kind of cable is the best I can recommend. Do not, in my opinion, directly burial any kind of flexible coaxial cable, particularly foam filled, unless you're convinced that it's got a foil layer underneath the braid. Or around or above the braid that is itself a nearly perfect hermetic seal. So flexible cables that are foam filled, even out in the weather above the ground, are going to give you trouble at some time downrange. Hardline's the right way to go, and you don't have to bother putting it in conduit and protecting it. It is self-protected just the way it is. I've done that. Works like a charm. In fact, a number of the cables I've got going across to 70 feet between the house and the tower number 2 are all directly buried in the ground. I did that around 15 years ago, and they're fully operational to this day, Mike. KD2 AMC, K2LIW in the Tech Map.
Mike, thank you, Dick. It's definitely something to think about. This is next summer's project, so I'm just doing my homework now.
Very fine, Mike. Let us know how that project works out. And so when it comes to getting hardline cable, 70 ohm cable, you want to establish yourself a friendship with a guy that runs the stockyard at a cable TV company, because they buy the 70 ohm cable, hardline cable, in 5,000 foot reels. When they're installing the stuff down the block and there's 200 feet left on the reel, they take the reel back to the stockyard. And sometimes they even throw it away, but they take it back to the stockyard. The average stockyard has got a whole bunch of reels with 100, 125, 150, 220 foot on them. And you make a deal with that guy, and quite often you can get those mill ends, as they call them, the end of the run on the end of the reel, almost free of charge. The connectors that you put on it is a little bit of a pain. In other words, the so-called, I'm trying to think of the name for the darn thing, the so-called stinger connector that you put on the end of the cable has just the right thread that will mate with a type N connector, a UG21 connector. And so there's a little bit of a mechanical rigmarole you go through in order to put a connector on the end of the cable. And if you're a real purist, you buy the coring tool that does a real precision job of cutting out the end of the foam so you can install the stinger connector. That's only cosmetics. If you core out that foam with your X-Acto knife or with your Swiss Army knife, and it looks a little bit homely, don't worry about it. The RF doesn't see the difference, if you know what I mean. You simply go and install the stinger connector, cut off the length of the stinger that's a little bit too long so that you can solder on the center pin of the type N connector, the type N male connector, the right length, assemble it, and that's exactly what I'm using right now. So, let us know how that works out, Mike, and ask your friends who's got a friendship with the guy at the stockyard for your local cable TV company. next guy on the list was Barry, N2 Moon Bounce. And by now you must be getting ready.
Repeater, timeout, repeater.
By now you must be getting ready for a tower installation over there in Far Rockaway, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, KQLIW, go ahead. And hope it gets better, so we get involved with the three guys who are really heading up the effort. Andy, WA2CDL, Eric, KE2EJ, and Bernie, K2YO. If anybody is interested in doing some interesting fox hunting, and you get a hold of those guys, well, they got some old, got some very good words they could lay on you as to the amount of fun they do, even when they do the practices on Friday night, so to speak. So I think I now know the answer, the question that you're asking, Barry, and sorry to say I don't know, but I guarantee if you talk to those other three guys, if it is known, they certainly will tell you. All right, the next person on our list was Neil, KD2 Charlie Mike Quebec. Go right ahead, Neil, K2RIW in the Tech Mask.
Yes, this is KD2 CMQ. I'm getting ready to try building some antennas. I'm going to start with a UHF, VHF, and what I'm looking for is a local source where I can buy some aluminum, either tubing or rod, and I'm also wondering if there's a spec that I should be looking for as far as conductivity and strength so it doesn't get mangled in the next Sandy-style storm. Over.
Okay, I know what you're asking. In the industrial court in Deer Park, near... This is a place that used to exist. Unfortunately, it doesn't. I think it doesn't exist anymore. Grand Boulevard, Deer Park, just a little bit east of Comac Road. There used to be, I don't know if it was